This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
If you mention the name Nashville, Tennessee, the first thing that often comes to mind is invariably music, musicians, and songwriters. Nashville is known far and wide as Music City, but it's also the home to a full-size exact replica of the Parthenon in Athens, Greece. How this incredible architectural gem came to be dates back to the pioneer days when Nashville was dubbed the Athens of the South due to its passion for education and the arts. When Tennessee celebrated the 1897 State Centennial Exhibition, Nashville contributed the Parthenon to house the arts building. Come along and join sculptor Alan LaQuire, who created the Parthenon's 42-foot-tall statue of Athena 8 decades after the conclusion of the centennial affair. We'll then visit with Wesley Payne, director of the Parthenon, as she shares the story of the Parthenon's creation, experiencing the 1897 centennial exhibition, saving and renovating the structure in the 1920s, and its use today as Nashville's Gallery of Art.
I'm Alan LaQuire.
Alan, tell me a little bit about your background.
Oh, I'm a sculptor. I was trained to do figurative sculpture. I began as a carver and later went to Italy and studied with several artists over there and learned to cast bronze. So most of my work is figurative and cast in bronze.
In junior high and high school, you
started as a carver in high school, actually when I was about 11 or 12.
What first took you?
I think it was just to see if I could carve stone. And once I started, I found that I really enjoyed it, and especially the moment when an inanimate block of stone sort of comes alive, and that became the fascination for me.
Does it ever come alive to the point that, say, you're working on an arm or something where it feels like it truly is animate?
Yes, it happens all the time. That's really the motivation. I mean, it's the mystery of sculpture, and it excites me in the moment, and sort of one work leads to another. It can be scary, you know, and the things that frightened me as a child sort of played into that. Finding the life within the inanimate material was a way of understanding and coping with the fear of that sort of stuff. And, you know, when I was a kid, I saw faces and everything, and clouds and trees and everything, so.
Moving forward, you were able to make a living and are making a living through your sculpture today.
Yeah, it's difficult. I had some really great teachers, and they knew how difficult it was. So they trained me to do certain things that they knew that I would be able to market at a later date. And one of those is doing portraiture. And portrait busts have been sort of the mainstay.
It's commission.
Yeah, commissioned portraiture. And then, you know, like the suffrage memorial, it's a group portrait. They're portraits of 5 ladies in Centennial Park in Nashville. And Tennessee was the 36th state to ratify the 19th Amendment. So we take credit for granting women the right to vote. And these are portraits of 5 of the most prominent leaders of the suffrage movement in Tennessee.
As an artist in doing this interpretive dimensional work, did you get to know them? Did you see them and feel them as human beings?
Yes, and that's part of the joy of creating a monument like this, is learning the history of each individual person as much as I can. That's what I like to do.
So they become, again, animate to you.
Right, exactly.
Talk about Athena and that story.
Athena was an amazing and wonderful commission for somebody right out of school, which is where I was.
And how did that happen? This is a major work. It's, what, the second largest sculpture interior in a building in the world?
It's the largest interior freestanding figure in America. She's 42 feet tall, right after I graduated from the University of North Carolina, the city of Nashville held a competition to recreate the lost statue by Phidias, and I won that competition.
What did you have to work with? What was it?
That's my daughter jumping around upstairs. I was very lucky because Nita Lipin, who is an archaeologist in Canada, had just assembled all of the existing known evidence for the original statue in a monograph, which I was given a copy of, and that was the primary research. The major research had been done for me, which was really great. But then I went to Greece, and I met with several archaeologists in America and in Greece and got their opinions, and as closely as I could tried to understand what their vision of the ancient statue was. And I did a series of models, and I subjected them to criticism by these archaeologists.
Backing up, here you are just out of college. I know I'd be scared. I'd be intimidated. And yet you had the guts to go, sure, I'll do that.
I may have been naivete, I think, to some extent. I didn't really understand what I was getting into. But I don't regret doing it. It was a wonderful project. And it was totally community supported. It is almost entirely privately funded with small donations. The starter donations all came from school children.
It was like nickels and dimes and quarters.
Exactly. Nickels and dimes put into a collection box inside the Parthenon. A lot of people don't know that we have an exact replica of the Parthenon in Nashville, in Centennial Park. And it's sort of the centerpiece of our park system in Nashville.
It really is amazing. I mean, never would have guessed. It's accurate to size.
The drawings were done by the leading architectural historian of the day, who was William Dinsmore. And so they are as exact as he could make them, you know.
Incredible. I want to dovetail back to you and Athena. This was no simple project. This took, what, a decade?
More or less. It took 7.5 years, and then I went back 12 years later and gilded and painted her.
So in that first 7 years...
We didn't really have a budget to allow me to hire people, so all the labor was volunteer. And my friends and family volunteered over and over and over till they couldn't stand it anymore. And they sort of quit volunteering after a while. But
you never got frustrated or disheartened. You just continually motivated.
Well, I have to thank the city because the park board at the time was very lenient in allowing me to take more time. But the problem was that over time our construction method changed.
Briefly, what is it made out of and how did you construct it?
It's sculpted in clay and then I made molds and then the molds were cast in a lightweight gypsum cement and it's fiberglass reinforced. Bears no resemblance to the proposal that I made that I won the commission with. It was my original construction method was going to be built directly in plaster over a wooden frame. Once they awarded me the commission, then the city decided that my construction method might be too heavy, and also that if we had an earthquake, it might be susceptible to that. So they wanted me to make a better structure. And so it's made in these, it's hollow. You can actually climb up inside her, which I do once a year to inspect her. And it's very lightweight. It's built on an aluminum, though the head is on an aluminum frame. Then the construction method changed again in the late 80s. And they were going to remodel the building, so they decided they could put a steel armature inside. And that would solve the earthquake problem. And so there are these four steel beams that go through the Parthenon floor and then through the basement to bedrock.
With shades of Statue of Liberty?
Yes, yes. And the joke is that if we do have the earthquake, the Parthenon will crumble, but she'll be standing on top of the rubble.
I love it. You know what? I hate to say it, but we're out of time. Okay. I'm going to come back and see you again. Okay. For somebody that wanted to learn more about you.
Yeah, it's just alanlequire.com.
Spell your last name.
LEQUIRE.
Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wesley Payne, director of the Parthenon.
The reason that there is a Parthenon in Nashville, which is unexpected, is that early in the city's history, it acquired the nickname Athens of the South. Well, it was Athens of the West first, and then the country moved west, and it morphed into Athens of the South. And that is probably because of an emphasis on education and culture from the time the city was founded. There was a teacher who came on the flatboats in the winter of 1779-80, and one of the first things that the city did once they were physically safe was to found a university. So, and they invited the acting president of Princeton to come overland in a covered wagon with his wife, and I forget how many children under the age of 10, to head up this new university in Nashville, and he did that. So because of that, when the state decided to celebrate its first 100 years as a state in 1896, with a big World's Fair type exposition, Nashville said, okay, count us in. We will participate in that, and we will build the art building, and we'll build it as a copy of the Parthenon to remind everybody that we're the Athens of the South. When the exposition was over, the grounds that had been covered with buildings and a midway and all of that were supposed to be cleared and sold and subdivided for residential development, but people in Nashville had fallen in love with the Parthenon and said, wait a minute, you can't tear down the symbol of the city, no. So there was several years of like, well, what are we going to do? Then in 1902, the newly formed City Parks Department purchased the land and then were stuck with this building that had not been built to be permanent. So in 1920, it had clearly come to a point where they had to either tear it down and forget it or make it permanent. And fortunately for those of us who live 100 years later, they decided to make it permanent. And you will see pictures of both the Centennial Exposition for which it was first built and the rebuilding as we go. In 1897, when the exposition took place, the upstairs, the inside of the Parthenon replica, was a series of galleries for exhibiting art. It was not a recreation of the ancient temple interior. That changed in the 1920s when the building was made permanent, and they moved the exhibition of art down to this lower level that existed but just as dirt, not finished off space. So we have art galleries where we have sometimes part of our permanent collection on view, temporary changing exhibitions, and then the upstairs, where we'll go in a minute, is a recreation of what we think this building looked like in antiquity. So in the absence of a time machine, this is the best you're going to get, I think, in terms of going back 2,500 years. This is a little bit of a difficult space, but take a look at photographs on your right. All the buildings were outlined in electric lights in a time when not every house or business had electricity. It was pretty impressive. And this photograph in this first case on your left here shows you what the interior looked like at the exposition. So this salon-style hanging of almost 1,200 pieces of art we're used to, and I personally think it's a better way to look at art paintings in particular with some space around them instead of crammed together like this. And you can see that the Parthenon is central there, but not the largest buildings. The grounds of Centennial Park have almost exactly the same footprint today. And you just name a building where Tennessee wanted to toot a horn and say, look at us, and we're a great place to do whatever. There was a building for it. The little lake that you see out front, or maybe you didn't notice it as you came in, and some people, when I say that, say, lake? I didn't see a lake. Oh, well, it's out there, and they say, oh, the pond, right. Well, they brought gondolas from Venice, and you could take a boat ride for 10 cents and have the gondolier sing to you and your sweetheart if you wanted. There were restaurants of all different kinds, and there was a local brewery called the Gerst Brewery from a German-American family named Gerst. They wanted to participate in the fair, but Nashville was dry at the time. And so the Centennial incorporated itself as a separate city in order to vote to be wet. They allowed beer and maybe wine, no hard liquor. And they had their own little mayor and police force, too. The guy who was the president of the exposition, a very good marketer, knowing that he was going to be doing this job of president of the Centennial, went around to other fairs the years before this one and scoped out good ideas. And one of the things he saw was that in Atlanta, at the Cotton States Exposition, they sold season passes, and he thought, now that's a great idea. But he also saw that people were sharing them with family and friends, and he said, don't like that. So he made the passes for the Tennessee Centennial photo ID passes in 1897. He was a very forward-thinking man. At a time when Nashville's population was under 100,000, this six-month exposition drew almost 2 million visitors during its time. So he was very successful. And the fair closed its books in the black. The Midway section had, among other things, two great rides that I really wish I'd had a time machine for. There was this thing called Shoot the Chutes. If you did it, you got a little badge that said, I shot the chute. So you'd go up in this cog railway kind of thing to the top, and this is actually pretty high, and transfer to a boat and come whooshing down into this water. At the end of the fair, when they drained these were Kearney people, and they packed up and went to the next fair. When they drained the pond, they found several sets of false teeth, which means people had a really fine time. And then there was this giant seesaw, which looks like an erector set kind of thing. Looks kind of rickety. And here is a person, so you get some sense of the scale of this thing. And keeping in mind that this is before the Wright brothers, this is even experiments in flight, to be able to go up in this thing and see your city laid out before you must have been pretty exciting, also pretty scary, I think. Intestinal
it's
fortitude.
It's really big.
It is big.
Really?
Yeah.
Big
and it would hold about 20 people per end. And then there were things like the Cuban village and the streets of Cairo and the Chinese village, which probably were not very accurate depictions of the culture they came from, but at a time and a place where the leisure hour and dollar were not available in great quantities to people, this might have been the only exposure to a really foreign culture that people had an opportunity to see and participate in. The big attraction at the streets of Cairo were the camel rides. This next section of photographs is about this interim period. So you can see at one of these that the Parthenon has ivy growing up the columns, and they've taken the pediment sculpture off because it was plaster. It wasn't intended to last forever. Yes. In 1920, they hired an architect and sculptors and began recreating the Parthenon. And rather than tear it down, they put scaffolding around everything, took off the roof, poured new load-bearing columns, did a steel truss roof with a concrete slab roof. They wanted to be accurate, so they purchased from England a set of casts of all the fragments of the Parthenon figures that still exist. And they are in the British Museum, and periodically you see a big hoo-ha about the possibility of sending them back to Greece. And they took the casts and actually used them. This is a fragment. You'll see this one upstairs. And here is how they used it. They added clay and sculpted the missing bits, and then made a mold of that composite figure, and that's what they used to cast what's on the outside of the building. So they were going for accuracy, did as much as scholarship would allow at the time. This is also an interesting place to film movies. I was talking earlier to Steve, who remembers the movie Nashville, and the climactic scene was filmed on the long side outside. And then more recently than that, the Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief movie filmed a scene here, which wasn't actually in the book. But it has, since 2010, when that movie was released, we have seen a huge uptick in particularly middle school kids and their families coming. And the children spend their whole time talking to their parents about who's who in the gift shop and on the sculpture upstairs. When the Parthenon was being made permanent in the 20s, the intent was to recreate the entire sculptural program of the ancient Parthenon, which is pretty elaborate. They ran out of money in the late 20s, and so for 50 years, this little maquette of the statue of Athena was a placeholder upstairs for the full-size statue. There was a little donation box put there sometime in the 60s, I think, and between mid-60s and 1981 or two, people nickel and dimed that little donation box up to about $30,000. School children who came here in the 70s can remember that they put a nickel or a dime in that, and that was the seed money for the commission that we finally paid a sculptor to recreate the full-size statue.
We've been visiting with the director of Nashville's Parthenon, Wesley Payne, who recently retired after an illustrious career. This show was originally recorded in 2017 and is reposted as a best of the best audio travel show in celebration of Journeys of Discovery's 32nd anniversary, producing radio travel features for NPR affiliate KCBX. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.